"I recognize you," he said. "You were at the Gunsmoke audition this morning." "I didn't get the part," she said. "You?" Well, greetings, folks. How are you? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Tickled pink, you decided to join me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Michael Bracken bring us our first story, and it's called Penalty for Early Withdrawal. 1957. Jolene Carver stood in line at the bank, her savings account passbook in one hand and a past due notice from her landlord in the other. Uncomfortable in the all-in-one girdle, stockings, and blank knee-length dress that she had worn for that morning's audition, she fidgeted in place. Only an hour earlier, she had been turned down for a non-speaking role on Gunsmoke, her third rejection that week. If she closed her account, she would have enough cash to pay another week's rent, buy a meal at the Woolworth lunch counter down the street, and purchase a stamp for the letter to her parents in Quarryville, Texas, telling them another lie about how successful she'd become in Hollywood. Then she would have to decide if she would entertain men for money the way her friend Martha did, or use the two-shot Derringer in her purse to put an end to her dreams. A few minutes later, after she had closed her account and was folding her last few dollars to put into her purse, a broad-shouldered man, wearing a sweat-stained gray Stetson and a red bandana tied around the lower half of his face, shouldered her aside. He snatched the cash from Jolene's hand as he pitched a canvas bag into the counter and pointed a revolver at the cashier. "Fill it," he commanded. He had a voice like a concrete mixer filled with gravel, a voice Jolene recognized from the cattle call audition that morning. "And don't dawdle." The masked man paid the struggling actress no attention as the wide-eyed teller shoved loose bills into the canvas bag. After she finished and pushed the bag back, the robber turned and bumped into Jolene. When he tried to push her away, she whispered, "Take me with you." "Lady," he whispered back, "I don't need a partner." She nudged him in the ribs with the Derringer from the purse. "I think you do." By then, the elderly guard near the door had cottoned to what was happening, and he stepped in their direction. "Hey, what's going on over there?" The robber wrapped his arm around Jolene and walked her toward the door as he waved his revolver at the bank guard. "You make any moves, old man, and the lady gets it." Though no one in the bank could see it, Jolene still had the business end of her Derringer jammed into the robber's ribs as they backed out of the building. A blue 1951 Nash Rambler hardtop waited at the curb, and he hurried Jolene across the sidewalk to it. He pulled open the passenger door and shoved her across the bench seat as he pushed himself in beside her. "You can drive, can't you?" The key was in the ignition, so Jolene responded by dropping the Derringer into her lap and her purse onto the seat between them. Mashing the clutch and twisting the ignition key, a moment later she shifted the car into first gear and pulled away from the curb. She could see in a rearview mirror that people were streaming out of the bank and looking in every direction.
You might want to take off the mask," Jolene said as she wheeled the Rambler around a Chevrolet Nomad filled with children who were pointing at them. "People in other cars are staring at you."
The bank robber holstered his revolver, then he pulled off the Stetson and red bandana, revealing a leathery face and gin blossom nose. He ran his fingers through his oily black hair, pushing it away from his face as he examined her closely.
"I recognize you," he said. "You were at the Gunsmoke audition this morning."
"Well, I didn't get the part," she said.
"You? You think I'd rob a bank if I could get work?"
She didn't respond because the answer was obvious, so she introduced herself.
"Jolene."
He responded in kind, but she couldn't tell if he'd given her his nickname or his screen name.
She didn't ask for clarification, but instead asked, "So, where are we going, Buck?"
"North," he said.
"Any place in particular?"
"Just north. Head towards Bakersfield."
Jolene had been monitoring the rearview mirror and had seen no law enforcement vehicles behind them. So she slowed the car until she was driving just below the posted speed limit.
"What are you doing?"
Buck demanded as he spun around to look out the rear window. "Trying not to attract attention," she said. "We've gotten this far without..."
"Hey!"
Buck had reached over and snatched the Derringer from her lap, startling Jolene as his thick fingers brushed against her inner thigh.
"Sorry,"
he said as he dropped the Derringer into the canvas bag with the stolen money,
"but you having this little party popper makes me nervous."
They rode in silence for several minutes before Jolene asked, "How much did we get?"
"Lady
Jolene," she corrected,
"we ain't partners."
"So how much?" Buck opened the canvas bag and counted the money. A few minutes later, he put the bag next to her purse on the seat between them and said,
$2,152.
That total was more than a year's pay in any of the jobs Jolene was qualified to work, and far more than she'd earned as an actress during her 5 years in Hollywood. She was still thinking about it when they entered the mountainous area of Los Padres National Forest, north of Santa Clarita, and Buck had her turn off the main road. A few miles later, Buck had her turn again, this time onto an unpaved, smaller side road that twisted around and up steep hills that strained the Rambler's engine before descending again. As they crested yet another hill, she saw far below that the narrow road took a sharp left near the bottom and that there were no barriers of any kind. As they began their descent, Jolene glanced at Buck and at the canvas bag between them. Halfway down the hill, Jolene did three things almost simultaneously. She shifted the Rambler into neutral, opened her door, and grabbed the canvas bag. Before Buck could react, she rolled out of the car and tumbled down the road. As the Rambler gathered speed, Buck struggled to move to the driver's seat to gain control. He shouted obscenities as the car careened over the side of the mountain. He was silenced long before the Rambler rolled to a stop far below. Jolene lay on the road for a long time before she dared rise. Though no bones had broken, she was bloodied and bruised, her dress and stocking tattered. The canvas bag had slid 10 feet beyond her, and she hobbled down the road to fetch it. She continued downhill to the turn and looked over the side. Unlike in many of the movies she'd watched, the car had not exploded and wasn't aflame. She turned away and then hesitated and turned back. She stripped down to her all-in-one girdle before removing most of the cash and her Derringer from the canvas bag. She arranged the cash in her girdle so that no lumps were visible. She tucked the Derringer between her ample breasts. After she pulled her dress back on, she threw the canvas bag as far as she could. Some of the remaining cash fluttered out and littered the mountainside. Then she began the long trek back to the main road. As she walked toward the highway, Jolene thought about everything in her purse and everything left behind in her apartment. Her driver's license, her library card, her resume, her 8x10 headshots, and more, none of which contained her birth name. She had changed it when she had moved to Hollywood, and no one in the state of California knew her as Jolene. She was still lost in thought when a black Ford pickup truck rattled to a stop beside her, and the weathered old man behind the wheel called to her through the open passenger window.
"Well, what's a pretty lady like you doing out here all by her lonesome?"
"Accident," she said. She jerked her thumb over her shoulder. "Back there a ways."
"Anybody hurt?" "Well, just me," she said. "Well, get in, honey, and I'll take you down to the diner."
Jolene hesitated a moment before she jerked the door open and climbed in. They rode in silence until they reached the main road and the old man turned north.
"There's a diner up ahead where I can let you out," he said. "You can call your people and have someone come get you."
A few minutes later, as they approached the all-night diner, Jolene saw a sheriff's department vehicle in the diner's parking lot. She said, "Keep going." The old man glanced at Jolene.
"You see something you don't like? The sheriff's car, maybe?"
She didn't respond.
"Something happened up in their hills? Something you don't want anybody looking at too closely?"
Jolene drew the derringer from between her breasts and jabbed it into the driver's ribs.
"Speed up," she said. "Drive past the diner and keep going." "Honey," he said, "you think that little pea shooter was going to frighten me? Well, I still have shrapnel in my back from World War I. If the Krauts couldn't do me in, what makes you think you can?"
"Drive," Jolene insisted.
"Don't talk."
He shook his head and pressed his foot on the accelerator. Once past the diner, he asked,
"Where are we going?"
She didn't have an answer, so she gave him the one Buck had given her.
"North," she said, "toward Bakersfield." "Ever been there?"
"No," she said.
"Bakersfield might be hell, or it just might be purgatory, but it sure ain't nothing to write home about."
"Are you a tour guide?"
The driver laughed. "Just an old man who's been around."
Jolene shifted positions. The currency trapped beneath her all-in-one was poking her in places that didn't like being poked, and she shifted position again.
"You got ants in your pants, honey?"
"What I got is a mouthy driver with a death wish." She again jabbed the barrel of the derringer into the driver's ribs.
He drove his right elbow backwards, smashing it against her wrist and causing her to squeeze the derringer's trigger. The bullet seared through his side, ricocheted off the shrapnel in his back, and returned by nearly the same path.
"Look what you made me do," Jolene said.
The old man looked down at the blood seeping from his side. Then he stomped on the brakes, throwing them forward as the truck ground to a halt. He bounced off the steering wheel while Jolene bounced off the dashboard. He hadn't engaged the clutch, so the truck lurched once and the engine stalled. The old man coughed and spat up blood.
I think you'd done what the Krauts couldn't."
Jolene pointed the derringer at him.
"Get out. Get out now.
I'll shoot you again. Get out."
The old man opened the door, stepped out, and kept himself upright by leaning against the side of the pickup. Jolene slid into the driver's seat, keyed the ignition, and shifted the truck into gear. A moment later, she accelerated away, and the old man fell to the ground.
Jolene pounded her hand against the steering wheel. Killing Buck had been self-defense, and she hadn't meant to hurt the old man. If he had just kept driving instead of trying to relive his war years, everything would be okay.
An hour later, she pulled into a service station and had the pimply-faced kid, manning the pumps, fill the tank and wash the windows. When he finished, she paid him with a sweaty $5 bill she'd pulled from her left bra cup when he wasn't looking.
"And bring me a Coke when you bring the change."
A few minutes later, he returned with a Coke from the machine at the side of the building, handed her the change from her five, and wished her a good day.
"Sonny," she said, "it can only get better."
Jolene downed half the soda in one long draw before keying the ignition and returning to the highway. She drove well into the night until the vacancy light of a motor court caught her eye and she pulled off the road. The human slug in the office looked her up and down as she approached the counter. Before she could speak, he said,
"And we don't rent to single women in ratty dresses."
"I ain't single," she said as she placed a sweaty five spot on the counter. "My husband's following in the Edsel. He'll be here within the hour."
"And he made you drive the truck?"
They stared at each other until she slid an extra five across the counter. The amount between them more than doubled the room rate advertised on the sign outside.
"How about now?"
He slid the two bills off the counter and pushed a key across to her.
"Cam and six," he said with a leer. "I'll keep an eye open for your husband."
Jolene parked behind Cabin 6, confident the pickup truck could not be seen from the road. A quick examination of the truck's interior and the truck's bed revealed nothing of value, so she let herself into the cabin. She stripped and had to peel away several bills sweat-glued to her torso before showering, washing her clothing in the sink and hanging her things over the shower rail to dry. Then she sat on the bed counting the remaining cash. After leaving some money at the accident site and paying for a tank of gas and her overnight accommodation, she still had $2,017. Jolene stuck the money in the nightstand drawer, put the Derringer on top of the nightstand, and slipped naked between the sheets. After tossing and turning for a few minutes, she fell into a deep sleep, a slumber that was interrupted a few hours later by the sound of the cabin door opening and closing.
"Your husband never showed," said the man who had rented her the cabin.
He grabbed the covers and jerked them off the bed, revealing her nakedness.
"I figured a woman like you might be lonely."
She watched as he stripped off his shirt, revealing his gelatinous gut. When he bent over to step out of his trousers, she grabbed the Derringer from the nightstand. When he climbed onto the bed with her, Jolene pressed the gun's barrel against the man's throat and squeezed the trigger. The fat folds muffled the sound, and his eyes opened wide in surprise as he reached for his throat. A moment later, he expelled his last breath through the hole. Jolene scooted away and off the bed, showered off the slug's blood, and pulled on all her still-damp clothing, except her ruined stockings. She rifled his pants pockets, emptied his wallet of $12, and took his key ring. She tucked the Derringer into her cleavage, grabbed her stack of cash from the nightstand drawer, and locked the cabin door before walking to the motor court's office. She let herself in, found the cash box and a small leather satchel filled with French postcards beneath the counter. She dumped out the postcards and replaced them with the contents of the motor court's cash box and the remaining currency from the bank robbery. Behind the office, she found a trash-filled 1955 Chevrolet Bel Air, settled behind the wheel, and keyed the ignition. Dawn was still a few hours away when she left the motor court and drove north, still headed toward Bakersfield for no particularly good reason. 2 miles outside of Bakersfield city limits, Jolene pulled into the parking lot of a 24-hour diner, the lot already occupied by several cars and a long-haul truck. She parked the Bel Air behind the truck where it wasn't visible from the diner windows, grabbed the satchel, and made her way inside. She settled into a booth near the restrooms, well away from the door and most of the other patrons. After the white-haired waitress filled her coffee cup, she ordered eggs over easy, hash browns, and toast, and listened to the farm report playing on the radio behind the counter. As the waitress delivered Jolene's breakfast, a few minutes later the farm report gave way to the news. The lead story was about the previous day's daring daylight bank robbery in Los Angeles and the discovery earlier that morning of Buck Sawyer's body in his wrecked Nash Rambler. Police recovered a purse belonging to an aspiring actress named Carlene Cartwright. They believed initially that Cartwright was taken hostage, but now believe she may have been involved in the robbery. Cartwright remains at large and is a person of interest in the ongoing investigation. When the radio announcer moved to the next story, Jolene carefully examined the diner's other occupants. None were paying attention to her, so she forked into her hash browns. While she ate, other diners came and went, including the long-haul trucker, as she soaked up the remains of her egg yolk with the last bite of toast. A California Highway Patrol car pulled into the diner's parking lot, slowed behind the stolen Bel Air, and then pulled into an open spot near the front door. Jolene waited until the broad-shouldered officer was seated at the counter, his peaked cap on the counter next to a short stack of buttermilk pancakes, before she slipped out of the booth with her satchel in hand. She made her way past him to the cash register where the white-haired waitress made change without conversation. Then she pushed through the front door. She glanced at the Bel Air, knew it wouldn't be long before it was reported stolen, and began walking. Every time a vehicle approached from behind, she turned and stuck out her thumb. She was almost to the Baker City limits when yet another car approached. She turned to see the highway patrol car from the diner slowing to a stop beside her, trapping her on the shoulder between the patrol car and a deep ditch on the other side. The officer inside killed the engine, then exited the patrol car and settled his peak cap in place before he stepped around the car. He was younger than she thought and had a face like a bulldog. "A woman like you shouldn't be out hitchhiking," he said. "It isn't safe."
"No, sir, it isn't," she admitted.
"Where are you headed?"
"Bakersfield."
"Well, you almost made it," he said, nodding toward the city limits sign. Returning his attention to Jolene, he asked, "What's in the bag?"
"My unmentionables."
"No purse?"
"Most everything I need is in here." She patted the satchel.
"Change of clothes?" he asked. "Looks like your dress has seen better days."
"Well, of course," she said. "But why change now and risk ruining another one?"
He grunted an affirmation, then introduced himself. "Andy Hearn. You?" She told him her real name, not the name on the identification she'd lost when Buck Sawyer's Nash Rambler went off the road and her purse was still inside.
"Nice to meet you, Jolene." He eyed her up and down. "Visiting someone in Bakersfield? Maybe I know him."
"Jim," she said, using the first name that came to mind. "Jim Arness." Hearn shook his head. The relief Jolene felt was soon punctured by a question.
"Doesn't he go by James?"
"Who?"
"Your friend," Hearn said. "He's in law enforcement, isn't he? A marshal?"
There are cops all over Southern California looking for you, Miss Cartwright, and I found you walking alongside the road? Maybe I should have you open that satchel just to be certain it's you."
"There's no need."
Jolene drew the two-shot Derringer from between her breasts and pointed at the highway patrol officer. The little pistol contained only empty shells, but Jolene realized Hearn couldn't know that. Using her toughest gangster mall voice and quoting lines she had memorized for a B-movie bit part that went to the more buxom actress, she said,
"Look, copper, there are only two ways this can end."
Hearn held his hands out to the side, well away from his sidearm.
"That the best you can do? No wonder you couldn't make it in Hollywood." "Don't make me shoot you," she insisted. "You won't be the first man I plugged with this thing."
The highway patrol officer looked both ways and saw no cars approaching from either direction. Jolene said, "Give me the keys to the car so I can get out of here."
"They're in the ignition."
When Jolene glanced toward the car, he stepped forward, grabbed her wrist, and twisted her arm behind her back. She dropped the Derringer and the satchel as she tried to twist away from him. She thrust an elbow back into his abdomen and stomped on his foot. He spun her around and drove her head into the side of the patrol car. Twice. Her neck broken, the fight left her, and she crumpled to the ground. Hearn adjusted his peak cap as he again glanced both ways along the highway. When he saw no cars approaching, he opened the satchel, looked inside, and whistled. Then he rolled Jolene into the ditch alongside the road, a few feet inside the Bakersfield city limits. He tossed the satchel into the trunk of his patrol car and drove off. Jolene had reached her destination. Whether Bakersfield was hell or just purgatory didn't matter much.
Well, all right, folks, on to the next story. I'm going to stay in the same Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine. This time it's Paul Grigg that brings us our story, and it's called The One Thing We Had in Common. Don't think the place ever had a name. So I called it the Thousand Acre Restaurant and Grill and laughed each time I passed it on the old number 4 highway. The rear of my van, loaded up with cheap fruit and veg bought from the open-air stalls close to the entrance to the Arab village, Dumat al-Jandal, named after an ancient Arab town in Saudi Arabia. This one founded after the Israeli War of Independence, when the Arabs fled the coastal plain to settle inland, leaving the visitors to build their kibbutzim and moshavim and nascent Jewish state. Thousand Acre stood at the extreme northern edge of the village, nowhere near the main entrance and traffic island, the worst place possible for a small business. Small? Well, not just small. Minute? A farce? Young Arab boy locked in a faded blue kiosk, one narrow serving counter, one limp sandwich, and one can of warm Coke for sale. To the right, a small rectangle of artificial grass about 1 meter square, with a single ex-kitchen chair for guests to eat that one sandwich or drink that one can of Coke, should they choose to stop and partake. Thousand Acre Restaurant and Grill. You could not actually stop because the number 4 highway, along that section, had no hard shoulder. Furthermore, the concrete drainage ditch cut deeply into the space between the kiosk and the highway. Passing Thousand Acre Ranch and Grill every day, I had to wonder at the depth of stupidity and deception the young kid had to have to open up his small business enterprise at that impossible point with such a meager stock and hope to make a living. With nothing more than a white bread sandwich and a single can of cola? Not the smartest business move if I'd ever seen, but I'd seen quite a few. I couldn't help but smile each time I passed before making the next left and following the 11-kilometer metalled road down to the beach and the Gallium Guest House. Yes, there it stood, the Thousand Acres, and there he stood, its young proprietor, 17 or 18, day after day, hoping for a miracle. Eventually, curiosity got the better of me. One morning on a return run from the vegetable and fruit stalls of Dumat al-Jandal, I continued to the turnoff for Gallium Beach, executed a quick U-turn, then drove a little way back and parked on the other side of the number 4 highway, where a strip of cracked concrete, courtesy of an old EGGED bus stop, provided a temporary hard shoulder. I skipped across the road and wide drainage ditch and landed with a 4-square thud in front of the kiosk's little counter, astonishing the Arab boy. Summoning my best Hebrew, I ordered his one sandwich and one can of cola. What? You heard? The kid extracted the limp sandwich from its display box, took down the warm can of Coke, and placed them both on the counter side by side like suspects in a police lineup. How much? I asked, reaching for my hip wallet. The boy had no idea how much either cost. I took pity and made a suggestion based on my own experience in the retail business. The standard price. The boy nodded, and I continued to nod as I handed over a 50-shekel note and took the sandwich, and the boy made change. I thanked him and took the sandwich outside onto his little patch of artificial grass, plopped myself down on the simple kitchen chair, unwrapped the sandwich, and took a bite. Chewed for 3 seconds and spat it out into the drainage ditch. Plucked open the can of Coke and swallowed enough of the to wipe out the toxic taste of the sandwich and went back inside, but not to complain. I asked the boy how he made a living. When the boy answered, I thought he had misunderstood my question.
His father had taken a loan, he said, a large one from a very bad person in Dumat al-Jandal, the sort of person you went to when there was no one else left, after Bank Leumi, or Discount, or Hapo al-Lamim, had turned you down, you didn't earn enough, or had no collateral. First name, Akim. I asked the boy if he meant a loan shark, literally translating loan and shark, hoping that he would understand my Hebrew composite, Kirshe, Alva, At. He did. The usual deal applied, interest that got worse after you missed a payment. The boy, and here I got his name, Sayed, told me his father wanted to build a house, and he thought, after many years of hard work and scrimping, that he just might succeed if he did a lot of the work himself and paid back the loan quickly. Then COVID came along. The man's day job as a waiter in a well-known Zishran Yaakov hotel and spa vanished. Naturally, the loan shark holding his marker had no sympathy for the economic effects of the novel virus. Debt was their business. They liked debt, worshipped it. Sayed's father endured threats and beatings, lost one eye, a slice of an ear, and whatever savings he had, including the land on which he had intended to build the new family home. And so on until this Akim fellow understood that further threats and beatings would achieve nothing at all. So Akim came up with this, the 1,000-acre restaurant and grill. As public humiliation for the father and a warning to all who thought COVID an excuse for not paying their debts, they would not get away with it. Look at the boy. Look at the boy's father. See what we did to him? Sayed had to work this kiosk every day, sun up till sundown, not to actually sell that sandwich and can of Coke, but to pretend to serve as a living lesson to the other villagers who drove by this spot every day. No point in running, of course. I knew the drill. If the boy ran, the loan sharkers would slaughter his father and put his mother and two sisters out to whore to pay off the debt. By coming out here every day with his one sandwich and one can of cola, Sayed protected both his father and his sisters. Or so he believed. Or so the loan sharkers led him to believe. All part of the standard playbook. Whatever the rate of interest, the boy's father would never finish repaying that loan again. Sayed would stay in his kiosk until he found little jobs for him to do here and there, running this, running that, until the police got hold of him, and then the courts, and down he went, taking the rap for others like all those who had gone before. I finished the can of warm Coke and placed it on the counter. The fact that Sayed had sold out his entire stock did not mean he could close up for the day and go home. The boy had to stay out there until the sun went down. As stated, Akim or one of his men would drive by and check. Nothing new there, not for me anyway, who had seen all this before and much worse. I made a face and said I had to go. I liked the boy. I pipped the van's horn each morning as I drove by his preposterous little roadside kiosk. Sayed, for his part, gave me a thumbs up on each passing. I thought of his father and his family and all the trouble the loan sharkers gave him. I pitied him and them. An odd emotion for me, considering the place I had come from and the things I had done, the life I had lived. Blasted by heat and fumes, Sayed sweated out the long summer in his roadside oven. Autumn brought a little wind and light cool rain, but then much stronger ones. Real storms and freezing temperatures. I never worked during the winter. I'd laid myself off and picked up the unemployment. Those few times I did pass his way, venturing out on small errands, the bank in Zishran, the bookshop in the mall for emergency reading material. I watched him, and I watched that ditch. The ditch filled, muddy water swished back into his kiosk so that he took to standing on an upturned milk crate. Sayed imprisoned in his bleak winter cell. I never stopped. I was too embarrassed. I felt very much at a loss. What on earth could I say to him? Chin up. One day you'll laugh at all this. As I said, my own little business tended to go belly up during the winter. I lived at the guest house all year around. The middle room in a row of holiday punters refused to rent. Too close to the road, too far for the beach, all of them curiously small, as if the original architect had put a decimal point in the wrong place. Guest house maintenance got the rooms on either side for storage purposes. Gardening equipment on the left, electrical and miscellaneous on the right. Eventually, winter eased into spring. The sun popped back into a blue sky, and I sanded and painted the beachcomber's front deck prior to opening again for the summer season. On my first official fruit and veg run to Dumat al-Jandal, a marker of sorts, harbinger of the year ahead, I pulled over again on the side of the highway opposite to Sale's thousand-acre restaurant and grill. I had a bad idea. Look, I told Sayed, I'm Yasi. I'm not, but let that slide for now. I have a small business of my own, just like yours. Well, not like yours, a real one that turns a profit. The Cafe Beachcomber. You may have seen it. Usual summer fare, snacks and ice cream during the day, and there's a kitchen at the rear where we cook fish suppers in the evening for guests who want to sit outside and feel the breeze or hold hands over a glass of chilly supermarket wine. So here's the deal. If you want to work for me, you can. After your own day is over, of course, so you don't break your terms and conditions, as it were. You work for me when you're done here and the money goes straight into your pocket. Free fish supper to boot, late shift at the Cafe Beachcomber, what do you say? The boy's eyes cut to a place just over my left shoulder, and I felt the hairs on the back of my neck prickle, if not actually snap to attention. In the reflection generated by Sayed's little display case, I saw what he had seen. An ominous black SUV had drawn up behind my van and stopped. Some heavy-faced clown got out and did the standard show-off gangster walk around in my van, kicking the wheels, trying the doors, locked, peering in through the driver's side for extra clues, all nice and attention-grabbing. Ball in my court, clearly. How to respond? I told Sale he could have the job if he wanted, dug into my pocket for enough cash to buy up his meager sandwich and can of Coke, and slipped across the highway, dodging the 202 bus to Zishron. Mr. Heavy decided to lean against the side of my van, cross his arms and legs in the classic pose of annoyed waiting. He stared at the sandwich I held in one hand and the can of cola in the other.
You like that? He asked in Arabic-flavored Hebrew. You like that sandwich, mister?
Best sandwich for miles, I told him, and took a big bite and chewed it just for him. Always stop and get one when I can, I said, nodding back at Thousand Acre. Really good. Mr. Heavy slapped my shoulder hard enough to rattle my teeth, then slid away along the side of my work van, gouging the paintwork with his key, a cut deep and ragged down through the paint layer to the metal below. When I went after him, about to take that key and shove it through his left eye, the driver of the SUV, an equally large passenger-side clone, jumped out. Flash commando-style knives, the kinds with serrated edges custom-made for slicing throats on nighttime raids. Mr. Heavy turned, grinned, and ducked in the rear of the black SUV. Akeem, naturally. Founder and president for life of the Dumat al-Jandal Loan Sharkers. I gave the hired muscle my best middle finger. They hesitated, but eventually backed off. A police car must have gone by. Neither of us wanted the police, the one thing we had in common. I didn't expect Sayed to show up at the Beachcomber, but show he did. 15 or 20 minutes after the sun had dipped its bottom into the sea, freeing him from his roadside imprisonment. The boy wooed everyone with his smile and quick charm. Proper little worker, the way he swept the outdoor deck, cleared tables, delivered hot suppers, took orders, opened wine, serving nonstop, dashing backstage to the kitchen to help the cook with his pans and pots when the pressure eased. About that cook, Broody Issa, also from Dumont El Jandal. Each night, Issa rode to the beachcomber on his moped, a Honda Forza 250, but never once offered Sayed a lift home on the back seat. One night, as we closed up, I asked Issa about that. "Hey, why not take Sayed with you?" Issa waved his hands at me as if warding off evil spirits. "No, please, Mr. Yossi. I cannot be seen with that boy. I cannot get involved. Life in the village, you understand? Arab life. Complicated, yes?" Each night I drove Sayed back to Dumont Al Jandal myself in the van, the two of us passing Issa on his new moped, head ducked as if those evil spirits he spoke of were in pursuit. The first month of the season shaped up nicely. Sayed on hand to take care of customers-related issues. "The fish has what, sir? Too many scales? Oh, I'll be back with a better one right away. A moment, please." "Wine night up to your standard. Wait 1 second, sir, while I dash out back and return holding the same bottle for your majesty's most expert approval." Sayed, in the kitchen, demonstrated secret culinary skills. Sayed at the pots and pans, scrubbing like a demon. Sayed scouring dirty plates and cutlery. Sayed swabbing the decks or dashing out into the warm evening sand to help the elderly couple that always took the corner table and tipped him well. Until the night when Sayed failed to show, which threw the cafe beachcomber into a tailspin. Only then did I appreciate the difference Sayed made. Somehow we muddled through without him. Next morning, on the fresh fruit and veg run to the open market stalls of Dumont Al Jandal, I didn't see Sayed behind his little counter at Thousand Acres. No sandwich on display, no single can of cola. Maybe some rich uncle had put up with the cash to pay off the father's debt or enough of the principal to release Sayed from his serfdom. Only after I passed did I see the boy poke his head up like a frightened puppy from below the counter. On the way back, loaded with fruit and veg, cheese, fish, and olives, I parked opposite the Thousand Acre and hauled Sayed out from behind the counter and saw what the boy had not wanted me to see. Eyes bruised, lips swollen, teeth smashed, bits of him loose and still bleeding. I let him go. No need to explain who had visited him, who did not like the idea of Sayed working for the Jew on the beach, even though I wasn't of the faith and never would be. I never should have offered Sayed the job. To top it all, as I turned away, the black SUV slid once again into the slot behind my van. Same dark windows. I could feel them in there, the loan sharkers, Akeem in particular. Sayed begged me to go. That night I woke at 2 a.m. to the wail of a police siren, or maybe an ambulance. I never did learn the difference, if there is one. I pulled on shorts and an official cafe beachcomber t-shirt and went out. Flames sparkled above the roof of the guest house reception and office building, but rose from a point much further back. I took the path around the office and then the bomb shelter to the beach. The beachcomber lit the sky like a bonfire on Guy Fawkes night. The siren had come from a single fire engine as it whooped by my door. A couple of helmeted firefighters cast loopy arcs of siphoned seawater back and forth onto the surging flames and what remained of the cafe beachcomber, the wooden structure too far gone by now to save. Down on the beach, I found one of the yellow plastic chairs the guests left overturned in the sand, spun it around, and sat there like a dumb idiot, watching the flames along with the guests, at least those guests still sober enough to find the Gallum complimentary bathrobes and stumble outside. The rear wall of the beachcomber cracked and split, tumbled and fell inwards in a feast of tiny hot sparks. I closed my eyes and listened to the snap and crackle of my vanquished business. I stayed there until the firefighters extinguished the flames and the guests returned to their beds and my feet turned cold. "You can come out now," I said, turning around. Sayed stood up from behind another of those overturned yellow beach chairs.
I am sorry, Mr. Yossi. They made me do it.
Of course they did.
Akeem says I am now part of his gang. No more kiosk.
Want to be? Part of their nasty little crew?
No.
Your Akeem is my Mr. Fletcher. Sayed came over and crouched down in front of me, facing the smoldering ruins of the cafe beachcomber, wrapped his arms around his knees, and dropped his head onto them in shame. "Ready to end this?" I asked. I waited for him to nod, as I knew he would. "Good boy. Like fishing at all, do you?" The boy shook his head. "Well, tonight's your night for liking it, and you'll thank me for it afterwards. There's a few old rods and tackle left around this place. We're going to pick up a couple and go down the coast a little ways and do some night fishing of your own, and you're going to tell me a few things, in fact, all the things I need to know to end this. All right?" Army. Got my first call up 6 months after stepping off the boat from Piraeus and taking out citizenship with the dodgy ID I'd picked up from the help of a Birmingham rabbi who liked his kiddie porn hardcore. I got hold of the porn, he got hold of the birth certificate, filled in all the forms, vouched in all the right places, and showed me how to pronounce my new Jewish name. Leal Yossi, son of Rachel and Mordecai, no longer dearly missed and taken too soon, but over 30 now and running around in Israel with Mr. Fletcher's money. The army wanted Yossi, like it wanted all the new immigrants under 35. I had no objection to the army. It would add veracity to the legend of Yossi Leal, new immigrant, nice young man doing his bit for the security of the state and, by implication, Jews everywhere. Hebrew, next to non-existent. 4 months basic, in the combat engineers, followed by 15 months regular service, then straight into the reserve cycle, where I made an interesting point of stealing weapons others left lying around. Oh, the odd M16, the left behind Galil, a few of them rusted hand grenades, and ammo, handfuls of the stuff, smuggled by kitbag into Galim, and buried in the banana plantation on the road down from number 4 highway. For a rainy day, for when Fletcher's boys showed up looking for that nice piece of change I'd taken off of them. Time to dig them up, only not for Mr. Fletcher, but Akeem, lord of the Dumat al-Jandal Lone Sharks. Banana fields stretched along the beach side of the number 4 highway, which meant I could head south on foot concealed by rows and rows of the stuff, which I did, dressed in my old army gear, until I came level with the main entrance to Dumat al-Jandal, spread out on the other side of a small traffic island. And I could see the cafe on the other side and to the left of it. Owner just slapping on his lights, then swinging chairs off tables in a rhythm long and familiar to him. I sunk back one row, crouched, slung the Galil rifle off my shoulder, and took experimental aim. Nope, too far. I wasn't that good a shot. I'd need to get closer when the time came. The initial plan of picking them off one by one now seemed wildly overambitious. I waited, pinching mosquitoes to death. Akeem and his mighty loan shark crew showed up after I'd slapped or squished about 50 of them. The boys in search of their first cups of strong Turkish coffee and unfiltered foreign cigarettes. 5 of them spilling out of that familiar, black SUV and through the cafe door in single file, settling at the far table, the one with the nice view of the entrance and door to the toilet and cinematic wide-range views through various windows. I crawled forward until a few banana fronds hid me from the pavement, hoisted the Galil into firing position. No, still no good, even worse, considering the angles. I traced backwards until I was out of sight of the cafe's windows, then dashed across the old highway, Galil in full view, and ran back to the traffic island, hit the cafe from the side, blasting out the window, spraying the end table with 7.62 by 51 millimeter NATO-certified cartridges. The loan sharkers jumped up and around as if the radio were playing their favorite hits of the 80s, a happy picture of waving arms and legs. I cut straight through the traffic island and into the nearest row of bananas on the other side, headed east, straight line to the coast, hit the beach, breathing hard, then waded quickly out into the shallow bay and beyond the natural breakwater into the deeper cross currents of the Med. I dumped the Galil and ammo, kicked off my boots and old uniform, stripped naked, and then swam north, ducking underwater for 20 or 30 seconds at a time to make sure the cool water washed any forensic muck from my hair, the kind that old man Fletcher used to warn his young killers against. "Clean up proper before you go home, boys. Don't want you getting into trouble." "Yes, Mr. Fletcher." Some hard swimming north and against the current. That's what happens when you let yourself get out of shape. You relax, stop paying attention, then get swept out. Twice I nearly lost sight of the coastline, lungs like boiling lava. By the time I crawled up against the rocks where Sayed waited patiently with a broken fishing rod and an old picnic basket, I must have swallowed half the Med. Sayed pulled a towel out of the picnic basket and spare clothes and trainers and put them where I could see them.
"You are a brave man," Sayed said at last. "Mr. Leal?"
On either side of our rocky outcrop, the sun peeked over the Carmel Mountains and lit up both sides of the beach. "Mike," I said. "The name? It's Mike."
Good and wonderful people, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour, this time here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thanks again for tuning in. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.